frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on February 10th, 2018 and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week it's a half episode, but Nate and Rachel join me to talk about homelessness and housing policy in the news from UK Labour, New Zealand Labour, and several US cities. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. This week we have a half episode, as we are going to be doing about once a month. So we're going to be talking about the issue of homelessness policy in several countries, not just the United States. This is something that you could talk about at great length for many episodes, so this is just kind of going to be a starting point. We're going to be doing an overview of the situation in a few different places that we thought was particularly notable. Let's start off with the United Kingdom, because the UK Labour Party has been making a lot of headlines recently with several policies related to housing and homelessness.
Yeah, well, there was news coming out a couple weeks ago, beginning of February, talking about how Labour is considering forcing landowners to give up sites for a fraction of their current price in an effort to slash the cost of council house building. And basically, there's landowners sell at a price that, I'm just reading from The Guardian here, that factors in a dramatic increase in value while planning content is granted. It creates the English Sovereign Land Trust that has powers to buy sites at a lower price. And the Labour believes that the current setup is slowing down home building by increasing costs. And they're looking at a change in a 1961 Land Compensation Act so the state could compulsorily purchase land at a price that excluded the potential for future planning consent. So basically this shakes out to about reduction of the cost of building about 100,000 council houses, reduce the cost by about £10 billion. To down to about £16 billion.
When they talk about the planning aspect, that in the U.S. parlance, the equivalent would be zoning changes. So basically like saying that because the speculated value can be a lot higher on the land if you say, well, it could potentially be worth a lot more in the future because of zoning changes. So they're saying that under this, that this English land trust would be able to buy the land similar to eminent domain, but that they would be buying it based on the real current value, not on the speculated value of future zoning changes.
Right. And so John Healey, the shadow housing secretary, has said that rather than letting private landowners benefit from this windfall gain, making everyone else pay for it, enabling public acquisition of land at near a pre-planning permission value would mean cheaper land, that which could help fund cheaper housing. So, you know, this is sort of strategy to, as you said, Bill, allow people to, the government to buy this land without paying all the speculative costs and things like that.
And they were basically, so that aspect was about the land value, which has to do with housing, but they were also potentially going to be buying homes directly, was another policy that had been announced by UK Labour.
Yeah, and some of that also goes back to the Grenfell fire. There was talk about potentially setting people up in estates and things like that, or just using, you know, not eminent domain, I think it was in the U.S. context only, but various other aspects.
Right. Something similar, they were saying that there were a lot of people, whether foreign or domestic, who had purchased housing, mansions and things like that, or high-end apartments that weren't using them because they were just using them as an investment vehicle. And they were potentially talking in the Grenfell context of just seizing those to provide housing And there was, and now they're saying, as a more general policy, not just for the Grenfell fire, that they would be considering doing that, I guess, as basically probably leverage to get people to unload some of these properties.
Yeah, and it was quite interesting, actually. The Chief Secretary of the Treasury, Liz Truss, apparently tweeted out about this policy that it was deeply sinister. And then apparently some other Tory former planning ministers, Nick Bowles, then tweeted back saying that this is a pretty decent policy, actually. Why should a few landowners receive all of the windfall profit from planning permission when the taxpayer bears the cost of infrastructure? Sort of making kind of like the conservative argument for it, like the pro-free market. This is, you know, sort of a better policy for everyone. But, I mean, it is interesting to see the sort of fractures within the Tory coalition. And you have other people saying this basically means that the Tories have lost the argument. And, you know, there's potentially some leverage there. So,
Rachel, what were your reactions to these Labour policies on housing and homelessness?
Well, I think it's very good because a lot of these land sites are owned by what are known as strategic landowners who are making money for investors by buying agricultural land that may be needed for future housing at low prices, securing planning consent, and selling it on for significant profits. So I think the Tories are trying to spin it that we're being mean to like individual landowners, but it's really faceless corporations of landowners that are really speculating on and driving these land prices up so much. So I think we need to keep in mind that it's giant companies, not poor rich people, basically, that are getting their land bought at a lower value.
Now, did you say that they themselves were securing like these zoning changes, the planning consent changes?
Yep. The Guardian article mentions one company called Legal in General, which boasts a strategic land portfolio of 3,550 acres stretching from Luton to Cardiff. So, yeah.
So that's not even speculative at that point. They're like actively changing the value. That's just straight up rent seeking.
Yep, okay. Exactly. So, yeah, they're not like friendly neighborhood people. They're these companies that are speculating and driving land prices up.
Well, I wanted to talk now about New Zealand, and then we're going to talk about the United States, some policy things at the local level regarding homelessness. And also, Nate is going to talk about the issue of micro homes or tiny homes, also in the U.S. context. But New Zealand Labour is no longer in the opposition. They have recently taken control of the government in the elections that happened last summer. And interestingly, they made housing and homelessness one of their core priorities that they were going to work on. It was one of the things they actively campaigned on. It was something they emphasized a lot during the elections. And a lot of that has to do with, it's a two-pronged issue, essentially. Basically, on the one hand, there's the housing issue, and on the other hand, there's the homelessness issue. These are related, but not entirely the same thing. They are very concerned, for example, that, you know, young couples starting out or young people in general are not having the ability to buy housing at a rate that they can afford in New Zealand. The new prime minister, Jacinda Ardern, had said at one point in an interview that it seemed like capitalism had failed young people or something like that, and maybe society in general because of the level of homelessness. And New Zealand obviously is not that large in population overall. So in terms of absolute numbers, not as big as some countries like the United States or Germany, for example. But New Zealand has the highest in terms of proportional share of homelessness in the OECD, which is the that set of 35 developed economies. New Zealand had, in 2015, almost 1% of the population of New Zealand was homeless. It was about 0.9%. That basically reflected a number of factors. Partly, it's that New Zealand has a relatively broad definition of homelessness compared to some of the other countries in the OECD. They were considering not just, as they call it, sort of the stereotypical population that people think of someone living on the streets, usually having a mental health issue or something. They were talking about whole families. Maybe they're crashing at some relative's house temporarily, or something like that, or they're in temporary housing or transitional housing or emergency housing or a shelter or something like that. There's all sorts of different definitions that they were considering homeless, which has come up a lot in the United States. I think people will not be surprised because of the U.S. tendency to sort of massage statistics. There's been this whole back and forth debate in Massachusetts over the past several years because the Republican governor kept wanting to change the definition of homelessness, basically to get the numbers to go down. They were going to exclude people who who were couch surfing because they didn't have anywhere else to stay. And the Massachusetts legislature was working on saying, no, you can't define out those people because they are homeless. They don't have a permanent residence and they're just staying, you know, at the mercy of whatever friend is available and has a place to stay. The other thing that has come up in the New Zealand sort of statistical issues, and then this relates to policy changes, is the issue of uninhabitable places that people are staying. There are some countries that don't count someone as homeless if they're sleeping in like an abandoned factory or something. It's not fit for human habitation, but they're staying there as, you know, some form of emergency shelter, basically, on their own. They found it or whatever. They're staying there. Many countries will consider that to be not homeless because they're not literally on the streets and they're not in a homeless shelter. Or you'll have really, really, really run-down apartments. You talk about the slumlord problem. And those people also count as not homeless in many cases. So New Zealand wants to address all of these factors, or at least New Zealand Labour does. They also point out that there had been a 44% increase in the absolute numbers of homeless people in New Zealand from 2001 to 2015. When they were in the opposition, they would routinely be attacking, and I found some transcripts from Parliament there, that the Conservative government under the National Party had bought four entire motels to provide what they called quote-unquote transitional housing, but the opposition referred to as emergency housing. They didn't just rent out the motel space, they actually bought four motels, and that was sort of their solution, but that's not really a permanent fix. And as the opposition had noted at the time, the Conservatives under the National Party had actually decreased the housing stock that was owned directly by the government. So that brings us up to the present, where now Labour Party is in a government. And they are basing their policy off of the inter-party report between them, the Green Party, and the Maori Party that had proposed various solutions. Their sort of top-line thing that got a lot of attention was banning foreign housing speculation completely. If you don't live in the country and you're just buying property to as an investment vehicle from outside of New Zealand, that will now be illegal. This is something that's been discussed in major cities all around the world. It's a huge problem in London, as we were alluding to earlier. It's also a major problem in cities like New York and Boston and other places in the United States. So New Zealand is planning to just pass a law to ban that, or at least the Labour Party is, now that they're in power. They also wanted to deal with domestic speculation because they don't want to just, you know, malign foreigners. The domestic side is to impose significant taxes on that. That's also been an issue in Australia. There was some news article that I saw going around Australian Twitter the other day, and they that was something like, oh, this poor couple purchased an apartment and they rented it out on Airbnb and they only made $35,000 in rents from Airbnb. And then they sold it for a $2 million profit or whatever after the land value went up. And now they're being expected to pay these huge taxes well in excess of the $35,000 that they made in income off of it. And it's like, yeah, but they also made $2 million off of the value changing, which again goes to the issue that we talked about with the UK Labour. On all these different countries, we're facing very similar problems, and dealing with the foreign speculation and dealing with the domestic speculation through tax increases and things like that, or outright seizures and with lower compensation as proposed by the UK Labour, that's going to continue to be an issue. Now, Rachel, before I talk about some of the specific homelessness policies, did you have any thoughts on the New Zealand aspects that I talked about so far?
Yeah, I would just like to point out that foreign speculation is a huge problem also on the West Coast as well. I think Seattle, San Francisco, Vancouver, Canada. So, yeah, I think curbing that foreign speculation is going to help a lot in the crazy spike in housing prices.
Yeah, just speaking about the West Coast, I was out in the run-up to the election in San Francisco, and it was quite amazing. You know, you would see like homeless encampments outside of like right near like where the Uber headquarters is, like sort of at mm-hmm. the very heart of this dystopic Silicon Valley. And, you know, you also had a lot of these sort of like gleaming sort of new condos that are going up and, you know, clearly not affordable for, you know, your average worker in San Francisco. And, you know, this is obviously a problem all across America and the world, but it seems like the West Coast specifically is sort of highlights the issue.
And a lot of these gleaming post-industrial sites aren't even occupied. I mean, there was
They're all like Airbnb or just people don't even live there. It's their second home.
There's a whole new tower of residences in the heart of downtown Boston. Like as downtown as you can possibly get. It's literally built over Downtown Crossing, which is a subway station and area of downtown Boston. And I think something like half of the apartments in this huge tower of residences, about half of them are not occupied for basically almost all of the year. So the other aspect, as I said, that New Zealand Labour wants to address, along with some of the other parties in the parliament, is the homelessness directly. And so they're proposing a housing first policy, which is something that has been around for a while. It actually started in the United States through nonprofits as early as the late 1980s. There was the big increase in homelessness starts around, you know, during the Reagan administration with some of the policies implemented then. But this is something that's been tried in various different countries with, you know, either the nonprofit sector or the government directly. New Zealand example is explicitly going to be based on some of the Canadian experiments. And if folks want links to any of this stuff that we were looking up for this episode, that's all going to be available at arsenalfordemocracy.com. We've got a huge list of links and notes explaining various aspects. So I have links about the Canadian program. And the experiments in Canada are still pretty diversified and disparate. They some of them include like that you would have to pay 30% of your income if you're someone that's being housed in this. Some of it's being run by sort of the city levels to test it out. They have different details in the program. So, you know, the details are always going to matter a lot. But basically, the idea of housing first is that you prioritize getting people into housing as quickly as possible, especially if they're newly homeless, so that you can sort of minimize the impact and disruption to their life, especially important for children, making sure that, you know, their life doesn't completely fall apart and that they can still be going to schools and stuff like that. The Canadian program also provides social services, funding grants for things like home improvements, maintenance and upkeep, even cleaning potentially, paying for your utilities so you're not just, you know, in a free apartment with no electricity. But the thing that's unclear to me from the New Zealand proposal, and I was looking for a while to try to figure this out, is I was not sure if their housing first concept was that they were going to directly buy the homes for people, you know, and give them to them in some capacity or lease them or rent them or whatever, or if they were just going to be contracting this out to like a private landlord or a nonprofit operator or something like that. Public housing stock in some countries is still relatively high. I think it's like maybe 30% or something in the Netherlands, but in most OECD countries, it's pretty low at this point. I think New Zealand's around 6%. So I'm not sure when they say based on the Canadian version, I don't really know what they have in mind for New Zealand in terms of the ownership, but the New Zealand proposal would involve providing permanent homes in some way, as opposed to temporary or emergency housing, and providing wraparound services, which would be something like the things that I mentioned, as well as like clinical help if you have a mental health issue. I saw the Canadian example also provides what's called complementary services, which are like optional sort of job and skills training things to help people, you know, get onto their own feet. And of course, New Zealand also adding some tailored reforms to account for things in the Maori communities, which is the indigenous population of New Zealand. Some things like multiple ownership rules and things like that, because there are some cultural differences compared to sort of the Anglo property ownership rules that are the default in New Zealand. And interestingly, the study noted, or the report noted, that the cost to quote unquote keep someone homeless as opposed to getting them a home was the equivalent in US, roughly speaking. I'm not adjusting here for the local purchasing power, which is an issue with the New Zealand economy because it's an island. But the direct conversion there would be $47,000 a year per person in US dollars to keep someone homeless. And they were saying that the estimated cost per person to provide long-term housing directly would be less than $12,000 US per person, which is just not a large amount. And if you think about that, like that's basically less than $1,000 a month, which is a fairly reasonable like rent cost in a lot of major cities. In fact, in some major cities, that would be a pretty sweet deal for a lot of people. And so, you know, if you're talking like, yeah, it's going to add up when you multiply it out over a whole population of homeless people. But if you're dealing with it, if you're breaking it down into actual rents per person per month, that's really a drop in the bucket for governments. And I think that's important to consider, as we'll be talking about when we move to the U.S. in just a second. The interesting thing, though, is that although this is kind of an interesting and positive proposal, New Zealand Labour did point out that the big pitfall with state-owned housing, aside from the critiques that various conservative cranks will make, the actual pitfall with state-owned housing is the tendency of conservatives, when they get back into government, to try to turn those into revenue streams. Basically, you know, instead of raising taxes, we'll just raise the rents on the people who are we've provided permanent housing to, for, you know, whether they're homeless or just needed affordable housing or whatever. If it's state owned and the government is collecting rents, instead of reinvesting that in purchasing more housing or maintaining that housing, conservatives try to, if they don't just sell off the housing outright, they often try to just say, well, we're going to make this into a cash cow, basically. So that obviously not great. So let's move to the United States now. Rachel, talk to us a little bit about Utah and Idaho. Obviously, in the United States as a whole, we're dealing with, as of 2015, a population of about 500,000 homeless people across the country. But let's focus a little bit into your neck of the woods.
Okay, so I think people remember a few years ago, Salt Lake City kind of coming out to great fanfare touting their Housing First program. The Daily Show sent Hasan Minhaj there, and he kind of went around asking people, have you seen any homeless people today? And so it was just this big montage of people saying no and him looking for homeless people. But the situation is a bit more nuanced than that. The success was somewhat inflated by a lack of nuance surrounding the definition of chronic homelessness. It's a period of homelessness lasting longer than 1 year, or four periods of homelessness over 3 years adding up to over 1 year. So they did house 900 people that were defined as chronically homeless. However, it seems like with the opioid crisis, the face of homelessness has now changed to kind of more of that couch surfing type of person, like you described in Massachusetts. They're often younger now than they used to be. The face of homelessness used to kind of be that 50-year-old alcoholic vet, probably. And now it's much more like teens and people in their early 20s who are addicted to opioids, kind of in and out of housing situations, just very unstable. So while they did put 900 people into permanent housing that were in that chronic homeless population, now the focus is on expanding outreach to persistently homeless, those people that are homeless for 90 to 365 days, with a homes not jails program. So it sounds like it's a private invested program, but investors will only get paid if metrics are met for reduced arrests, improved employment wages, and service hours worked by participants. So I think the fact that they are kind of shifting their focus and kind of evolving their stance on housing homeless people is definitely positive, but it sounds like they have a long way to go to kind of reach that zero homeless people thing that they kind of touted on the Daily Show.
And all those rich people living in Utah, and they still won't do this through, you know, a tax and spend system. They're trying to do it through a private investment system, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. I think it is kind of encouraging that they won't get paid unless metrics are met, but it's still, yeah, they're...
Like, why should they get paid at all?
Exactly. Like, they're still going to get paid if the success is met. So, it does kind of leave a bad taste in the mouth. And also, state and local officials are trying to break up. Currently, there's a large homeless center on Rio Grande in Salt Lake City, and they're kind of trying to break that up into smaller dispersed facilities to replace that current center. So now their efforts are meeting with a lot of NIMBY people. So a lot of the neighborhoods that would be affected, there's an outcry from the residents there. And also, I think there's a concern that there's a lack of transparency in communicating this to the homeless population. So there's a lot of like uncertainty surrounding their fates. I think as long as the state and the city are more transparent in what they're trying to do and kind of curtail the worries of the homeless population, I think that would go a long way to building trust among the homeless population.
Now, tell us a little bit about the situation in Idaho.
Okay, so over the past decade, I would say, with the recession, our homeless population has expanded a lot. I think we have over 300 homeless people, according to the latest census. And I know the numbers are usually way off just because they pick a day and count all the homeless people in a year. And that's kind of their official number. So I think it's always underreported. But the city of Boise, in addition to Ada County, are building a 41-unit building in West Downtown Boise. One unit is going to be for like a case manager, just kind of a supervisor, and 40 units will be for homeless people. I'm not sure if they're single occupancy or more family occupancy, but this should be opening this fall. They're going to provide vouchers for rent and utilities, so kind of allaying those fears that the people would just get kicked out for not paying rent or not being able to cover utilities. And also, they are going to try to provide some of those wraparound services that you referred to earlier. So there's a local low-cost clinic called the Terry Riley Clinic that is partnering with the two main hospital systems in the Treasure Valley to provide health care, detox care, mental health care. So they're going to try to attack the root of the homelessness issue, which is often substance abuse and mental illness. So I think that sort of like multi-pronged approach has the potential to be very successful in Boise.
Nate, I want to close on this issue of tiny homes. You mentioned earlier about homeless encampments in the heart of Silicon Valley with all this tech wealth floating around. That's something that's sort of been kind of, I don't know, a trendy, buzzy thing to talk about is these tiny homes. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it has sort of gained, some prominence in the media. You know, you have these like stories about, oh, these like little encampments and, oh, the homes are so cute. They all have Murphy beds and formerly homeless people are sleeping in them. Thought it was interesting. Here's a story in the San Jose Mercury News. San Jose proposes just two tiny home villages for homeless. First, there were 99, then there were four. Now there could be just two, saying that there's been a big backlash from neighbors. And city housing officials are now just recommending two tiny home villages in San Jose, down from an initial list of nearly 100 potential sites for the homeless. While NIMBYism, people who oppose homeless housing in their backyards, is not new, advocates say that the current level of vitriol is unprecedented. Some speculate it's fueled by the current divisiveness in the national politics. I feel like over the last year or so, these conversations have gotten consecutively worse, said Jennifer Loving, who runs the nonprofit Destination Home. They're saying things like, go back to where you came from, or build a wall. The level of public discourse has become more and more angry. And then, you know, you have testimonials from people, you know, this gets me upset, said Bernard Giles, 56, a former construction worker who became homeless after his rent went up $400. We're not killers, not bad people. We're not trying to spread love. The rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. So that's sort of the view from the ground there, you know, and it maybe sort of speaks to the difficulty of, you know, relying on sort of these tiny homes as the solution, because whenever you have sort of like a small selected program, you know, whether it's a government program or some sort of like housing thing, then it's when it's specifically targeted for, oh, this is for, you know, these, you know, extremely needy people, the homeless, the extremely poor, it's easier for people to sort of try to get it cut or try to oppose it. Oh, not in my backyard. And so if you move maybe towards a system where just everyone gets some sort of housing, it's much more of a universal housing is a human right type of thing. So that's just sort of my worry. If, you know, you see this sort of NIMBY backlash that seems to be happening. Although, you know, it does, as long as there are people are building these mini houses, probably better that someone has that place to put a roof over their head instead of not. So yeah, that's sort of my concern on that.
All right. Well, as I said at the beginning, lots more we could talk about on these issues, but we wanted to cover some of the highlights from several countries and cities. Nate, thank you so much for being here in studio this week to talk about all of this.
Thanks, Bill.
And Rachel, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.